Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. We are so pleased to have on the air San Francisco Bay Area author, journalist, and political columnist Jesse Douglas Allen Taylor. Once again, we had him on when I hadn't read the novel, and now we have him on again now that I've finished it. Good morning, Jesse. How are you?
Good morning. How are you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Oh, great. It's always great to have you on, and just really, really excited about talking about Sugary Rising. Again, now that I've become familiar with some of your great cast of characters, they are so phenomenal.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Really, really wonderful array of strong women and quite intriguing also as well. And just the whole setting of the story and the underlying tale within the tale is really interesting. You know, this historic, you know, fiction, because, you know, the period and the moment that you write about with regards to the flood and people having their homes and graveyards and all these other important places and spaces that one cannot duplicate is something that really happened. So let me continue introducing you. Your novel, Sugary Rising, set in the South Carolina coastline area of Low County in the late Depression years, is a story of a community resistance to a massive community relocation forced by a Tennessee Valley Authority style dam building and rural electrification project. The novel also details the struggles of a unique group of Low County African American people, commonly known as the Gullah, to maintain a religion and culture largely derived from their ancestral African homeland. Your novel is loosely based on the Santee Cooper Project in the 1930s era initiative that carved out two major lakes in the heart of South Carolina, brought electrification to scores of rural communities, but in the process dislocated more than 900 families, most of them African American. And what happened, you know, with regards to that dam project has happened many times. There didn't have to be water. It was just, okay, we just want that land. So African people have been displaced and relocated quite a bit.
We're seeing that in the Bay Area as well. I mean, yeah, it's going on all the time. But I think one of the ironies, and this is something that I had just found out, there's some new studies being done. The project was done for electrification, and people were promised that they could have access to electricity. And then what happened was a large number of the people who then got relocated didn't have the money to pay their electric bills. Mm. So they ended up in the dark anyhow.
Wow, that's really amazing. Yeah, and you know, these African people that you tell the story through, you know, their mouths and their eyes. It's a big deal because, you know, in your story you set up that, well, they've been, you know, sort of talking about flooding out, you know, the lowlands before. And the crop that is a real staple to that community is rice.
Mm-hmm.
And the folks that are on the other side of the river, you know, they have their own unique ways. And people, what do you call those two different communities? Like one, you know, the community that does the rice farming that has the more traditional African ways, and then the other folks that are more assimilated. There's kind of a tension there, and the white folks over there and the black folks over there sort of like look at the community that you tell us about. It's not really fear, but they don't mess with them.
Well, part of the book involves the vast differences in African American people and communities, and in this case, they're only separated by a river. The community we're talking about is called Yellowsaw Neck.
Mm-hmm.
It's somewhat different from the Gullah. I mean, if people are familiar with Gullah of South Carolina, they have, to this day, largely maintained African culture and African dialect. At one point, it was a distinct language. It's now more or less a dialect. But the people of Sugary Rising, my book, have not only maintained that culture, but they've also maintained African religion. And that's one of the first things that we lost is we kept religious practices, but not in many cases the complete basis of African religion. So the people of my book have that. And in a lot of cases, I mean, when I lived in the South, you would see that you could go on one side of the river or the other, and they were just only completely two different worlds.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Before we talk about Sugary Rising, we were speaking about Harriet Tubman, Secret Agent. I was telling you about a book I just finished by Thomas B. Allen. She's one of your names, and looking at how the story that people don't know about how daring African formerly enslaved people were in helping the Union win the war. I mean, if it wasn't for the information gathered by what they call contraband, you know, a lot more lives. I mean, so many lives were lost. I mean, oh my God, it was a very tragic war on both sides. I mean, so many people were killed and so, you know, and maimed, and it was just really horrible. But the Africans, you know, both, you know, within the camps and within the households, all the way to the president of the Confederacy, were just my goodness, just such a wealth of information, and Harriet Tubman, General Harriet Tubman, she was one of those folks, and she actually was really instrumental in getting organizing the folks, the Gullah folks, in Virginia, and
so well, South Carolina.
South Carolina, right? Sorry.
Near, you know, just across from Savannah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we were talking about the Anaconda Plan, and you were telling me that, you know, you knew that because I was reading. It's like, oh, that's the Gullah folks. That's the same people that that Jesse's talking about in his book, and then you were mentioning that that Colonel Robert Gould Shaw, the white commander of the newly arrived 54th Massachusetts Regiment, a black unit had been organized in his day by Governor Andrew, that she had served him his last meal. And I said, yeah, that's right, I just read that. And in that particular regiment, two of Frederick Douglass's sons served. Mm-hmm. And this was like one of two really well-known regiments, because before they didn't actually have black regiments. They were calling them volunteers and things like that. So I was wondering if you could sort of maybe put this incident in the context of your story and the region, since you know that history really well.
Well, one of the reasons I wrote Sugary Rising is a lot of times there's a break in our history. We talk about the period of slavery as if it happened to the slaves, and then we talk about our history after that. And I mean, one of the things that, you know, when I lived in South Carolina and I came and I would, you know, talk to people and I would talk about the slaves, and I noticed that the way people there talked about it was they talked about something that happened back in slavery time, and I'd be talking about the slaves and they would be talking about back in slavery time. And it took me a while to realize that the difference between the attitudes, my attitude was, and the attitude of a lot of African Americans, is almost that that's a different people, and almost that that's a wall. And people in South Carolina were saying, no, that's us just in another time. Mm-hmm. And so they saw an unbroken, string between the things that happened in slavery time and the things that happened afterwards. It was the same people, it was just different things happening and different conditions. And we saw that. I mean, a few people have tried to do that. I mean, you know, bless his heart, Alec Haley, you know, brought us so far in roots in taking us from villages in Africa into slavery and out of slavery. And that first real novelistic connection where African people begin to look at ourselves as the same people. I mean, you know, we know that intellectually, but to feel that emotionally. So one of the things I've tried to do in the book is to try to show, in going back to the period of slavery and moving them forward, that you are dealing with the same people in the same region, and it's simply a different it's a different time period and a different condition, and that's one of the reasons I said it in South Carolina, because there's so much history there that remains. I mean, people. Many of the people live in the same communities that their ancestors lived on plantations. Mm-hmm. And so all of those stories were what inspired the book. I mean, you know, there's, you know, a good deal of the book it deals with the fact of that same period where the Northern soldiers came, and the question about, you know, people being freed when the Northern soldiers came. And that's the period when Harriet Tubman came through. Mm-hmm. I guess that was 1862.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, let's talk about Sugary Rising. Mm-hmm. And these families really tightly knit community and the dilemma that they're facing. It's really, really interesting the way you have the news come, to the residents, you know, they have this family. It's really interesting, really African the way you have it set up. They're these family of I guess messengers, and that's what they do. They carry the message to the, you know, from one place to another, and that's what they're known for. And mm-hmm. And then we meet Yali, who is a young woman, sort of coming into herself as an adult, as a woman. She's still a child.
Yeah, she's 15 at the start of the book.
Mm-hmm, right. Yeah, and she's got power, you know, that. She's not really, doesn't know exactly, we don't know, and she doesn't either, how much power she has, but it's like, wow, you know, as you develop her through the novel, you know, she becomes a real pivotal figure, because she can go back and forth, you know, sort of between the past and the present and the future, and the ancestors talk to her. So it's really cool. And then you've got her mother. Her mother is a really interesting woman, because she doesn't have to say much, and things sort of happen. Like, she doesn't want people to speak about a certain thing, like the water coming, you know, the river, you know, the dam project, and then so then they won't speak. So you want, like, wow, it's like, where, you know, you think about sort of the patriarchal system, but this seems to be a serious matriarchy going on. In that particular family, it seems like the woman is the one in charge.
Actually, I've thought about that a lot. I don't think so. I think a matriarchy is where you have an absence of male leadership. I think.
Oh.
I mean, one of the things that happened, and I guess we talked about this. You know, we talked about this earlier, mm-hmm. that about the strong women characters in the book, and you know, there's a number of them, and they're very pivotal in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize how strong the women characters were until after the book was finished. I mean, or maybe while I was writing it, and I knew, you know, what they were doing, but I didn't realize how key that was to the book. I mean, I wrote the book in part to talk about resistance and the different ways that people resist, and particularly African Americans have resisted in the years before the Civil Rights Movement, you know, when there weren't television cameras, you know, when people weren't paying attention. How did people resist and survive? And I also wanted to see that very long connection But I didn't realize until later that, you know, part of it was, I guess I wrote very strong women characters because the community that I was writing about had them, and it was impossible not to write these women characters. Mm-hmm. The reason I wouldn't call it a matriarchy is that you also have very strong male characters.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not as if, you see a lot of literature where there's very strong women characters because the men have disappeared.
Mm.
And, you know, they're not around, and so therefore the women are taking control and they're in the leadership positions. I mean, the society I'm talking about is the society where you have very strong male figures. You don't have an absent male figure. So when the women are strong, they're strong in relationship to very strong men. And there are battles between the men and the women in terms of battles of will. Also, we have so many books that have angst in black families and, the disruption of, and disintegration of black families. And I didn't want to write a book that did another book that says, oh, black men and black women can't get together, you know, and families can't exist. The women in the book exist within a really strong family structure,
mm-hmm.
and they're part of that strength. But it's not as if there's a battle where men are going one way and the women are going another way.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you. Yeah, it's just when we look at, let's say, Grandpa Booty's, is that how you pronounce his name?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
His home, you know, where, you know, his wife passed and she was a healer. Was that mother, Nana Kishi?
Oh, Narisa.
Narisa? Okay. And then the daughter who ends up taking care of him, you know, when her mother mm-hmm. passes, she passes, and then so we look at Grandpa Booty and how he runs his house, and then we look at Yali's family, the Kinlaws, and how, you know, her mother and father sort of, you know, they negotiate and they talk, and yeah, and it's a real different kind of household that they have, the way it's set up.
Well, I lived for 20 years in South Carolina, and I mean I loved a lot of the relationships between people, because in a lot of instances, particularly the older people, and Thibaut Manigo and his wife Narisa are based upon that, mm-hmm. in that they are always talking about each other. But and if you think it's as if they're dissing each other and they don't like each other, but they are able to do that because of this deep connection and this deep love. And so you have these older people who, you know, the longer they stay with each other, the more friends they become with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And the more they understand each other, and they have this relationship where they can have disagreements, but there's never any sense that they're going to end this relationship. They could be mad with each other about certain instances and certain specific things, but they're not about to fall out. You know, it's not about infidelity. It's not about, you know, they're each ones are doing the things that they need to do to keep the household together. I mean, I think, Papa T is always talking about, that woman who stays with me, and she's talking about, that man who's always around the house. And again, I mean, I used to see the old people talk about that, and I was thinking, what are they talking about? Don't they like their husband? You know, but actually they do. They love them so much that they can talk in these terms as if it's sort of a casual relationship because it is such a deep love.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think we have, we're looking sometimes in our literature and in so many ways where there's disagreement and where the black family is gone. And I didn't want to write a book about that where we just talk about everything falling apart. Mm-hmm. I think that the world, and I guess a little bit about the world and what's happening in the book, mm-hmm. which was based upon historical events in South Carolina. The state of South Carolina and the federal government proposed to build a dam, which flooded out, hundreds of acres and caused, I guess, 900 families to be relocated, and so this entire community is in danger of being wiped out. And I guess the purpose of the book is to show that even with a community in danger of being wiped out, these relationships, these family relationships, are not wiped out, and mm-hmm. and they exist and they continue. It's enormous strength, and that's, I mean, I wrote about that, the strong women characters and the strong male characters. I wrote what I saw, mm-hmm. and that's what I saw among these people, that you had this enormous strength in the face of things, that would beat some of us down. I mean, they were able to resist and keep this love and keep these families together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you also write about these spirits, because, the swamp is alive. The water, the river is alive because the men have to take a journey. There are a lot of journeys. The men take a journey. Yali takes a journey. But then it all sort of comes back, it's basically sort of, what do we do with this information? Do we stay put? And the water is rising, like we have to do something. And do we want to go forward? And if we go forward, what do we have to leave behind, of ourselves, because you can't take it. If they flood, if things are flooded out, you think about what's going on in Sudan right now around, the threat of flooding the pyramids and, mm-hmm. and what's going to be lost. I mean, you'll have to, get in your deep sea gear and go swimming down below the water to be able to find those antiquities. So, it's like this change is so huge.
Well, part of the issue of the spirits within the book is that in Western literature, if you're going to have spirits in a book, you have to tell people in advance. Okay, there's going to be ghosts in a book, and then people say, okay, well, there's going to be ghosts in the book, and okay, we'll accept that, and they'll go along, and they're fine with that. In African literature, spirits are part of the fabric of the world. They come in and they affect the world, and so this is a very much as an African landscape, and so the spirits are very much deeply a part of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we've been teasing our listeners. So now, why don't we just tell them? Why don't you just give us sort of like some of the main characters and little information about them, and then we can talk about this journey that Yali is sort of guiding us through. I'd like for you to maybe hang out a little bit in the, the place where she gets trapped, and I don't know if, I don't remember exactly, but it's like the deep woods, and there's the Goma tree, which is like a person, and there's some life there that's trying to take her. There's some spirits there that are living, and it's just really interesting, that whole landscape when she comes to the house and she sees her grandfather on the porch, because what happens, well, you can tell the audience, but what happens is the grandfather...
Well, I don't want to spoil...
Okay,
I don't want to spoil some of the things in the story. I'd rather people read the book.
Okay. So what can we talk about?
Yeah, I mean, just that, because it sounded like you were getting into telling some things, and I think one of the storyteller doesn't want the end of the story to be known. They'd rather have people.
Oh, of course.
hear
almost
going
to go all the way to the end, but anyway, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. but I think that again the story is it, for me was the and the reason I wrote it was the issue of the resistance and the way the different ways that people resist the dam building as well as the continuity. And again, I mean, the character of Yali was taken. I met a woman one time, a young woman. I wish I could remember her name. And this was way out in the country in South Carolina. And I can't remember why I was visiting her house. And she was sitting out in under a tree. And it was in the, you know, in late spring, and it was kind of warm, and she was sitting out there, and she seemed really sad, and we were talking, and in the course of the conversation, I found out that she, every night that she would, she had these dreams, and these terrible dreams, and these visits and things, you know, visited her in her dreams, and she couldn't escape it. I mean, you can't not go to sleep. And she had just resigned herself to that. So it, she had this great sadness about her that she knew that in the evening, you know, she was going to have these dreams and these things, these, what seemed to be very terrifying things were visiting her and she couldn't escape those. I don't think I ever had a relationship with her and that I even knew her name. I think I just knew her family. And I only saw her that one time. But she became the foundation of the character of Yali Kinlaw, of this idea that you have people who really do exist in more than one world. They exist within the world that you might call the real world or the natural world, and they exist within the spirit world. And that's why, I mean, there's a term about literature that some people call magic realism, mm-hmm. where, you know, you have things that, you know, couldn't possibly happen in the real world, but you have them happen anyhow, you know, as if they're magic, and you say that that's, you know, that's real, and that becomes magic realism, and there's a whole, you know, body of work about that. And this is really spirit naturalism in that, it's things that are happening, that happen to us all the time, that really have a spirit. You can't tell whether it is actually spirit-based or it's in another. It's in what we call the natural world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's the character of Yali. That there's a number of people mm-hmm. in the book who exist within these two worlds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you look at Yali and her, the old man who is like the elder in the community, and he is so close to the brink. Oh my goodness, your descriptions of him are so phenomenal. I mean,
oh, Baba Zambu.
Yeah, he is so good. Oh my goodness, tell us about him.
Well, Zambu Dingle is one of the people. The book takes place in the 1930s, and this is one of the things that for our generation, your generation and my generation, that we've lost. We don't have a living memory of slavery, which is to our loss because a lot of the wisdom died off when those people who had been in slavery left us. But in the 1930s, you still had people who had been part of slavery, who came out of slavery. And so, and Baba Zambu, who is the elder, and he's sometimes called the eldest within the community, mm-hmm. Is he has the knowledge and the information that comes back all the way across the ocean from Africa, and carries that with him through slavery, and so he's very old by the time of the book, and is the spirit leader. And you had, that's one of the African characteristics of this community, that it's not, there's a council of elders, which is common in Africa, but sort of people have a misapprehension of that. Do they think, okay, well, these people set down the laws, and it's like an in isolation, and they don't listen to everybody else. I think the Council of Elders is more the people who have the experience and who are the wisest, but they can be challenged and they can be countered. But they're venerated; they're very venerated people, and they exist as the political and at the same time the spiritual leaders of the community. So Baba Zambu is one of the characters within the book who encompasses the reach, you know, all the way back into, you know, across to Africa, and then into freedom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's he's really great. And then there is the spinster aunt who inherits the care of her father after her sister, Big Sister, passes. Big Sue, right?
Oh, Big Sue, yeah.
Uh-huh. And she is a medicine woman. She practices the African religion, and she is in a house where can I tell them what happens between her and her father? Or is that messing up stuff too?
Oh, no, you can say that.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, well, she leaves her father's house because, he's not really nice to her. Let's put it nicely.
Grandpa, they don't get along.
No, she's not her sister. And that's her sister's the one whose funeral we go to visit. Is that Sister Ori? And so when she goes to live with her sister Yali's mother, Yali's mother tells her, you know, you can't be bringing that juju in this house. We don't do that here. So she has to, and she gets to bunk with Yali, because Yali, I don't know, because she's the youngest daughter. She has more space in her room or whatever, but her aunt, I guess it's her great, no, her aunt, stays in her room. And that's really interesting because Yali has dreams, which is really another cool thing that you have going on in the book because her dreams are so vivid.
Well, the houses are built, the way people built their houses, they usually started off, you ever heard the term shotgun house?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah,
and on one end you can shoot a gun, and the bullet
goes
through.
Yeah, I mean it's like one hallway, and you know you go through the front door, and you could shoot a shotgun, and it goes down, and it shoots out the back door. That's what they used to call these shotgun houses. And what happened is they would build them and add on to them as they had children. So the reason that you have Big Sue moving in with the alleys, there's only one room for the girls. And they had several girls already, but they've married and they moved out. And then they had a room for the boys, and on the other side, a room for the parents. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of how, you know, the houses were set up, where you'd have one room that was the living room and the dining room, and often the kitchen as well. And the sitting room, it would be one big room, and then the bedrooms off to the side. A big part of the book is the relationship between Yali and her grandfather, which is, and the grandfather is one of the main characters in the book, and his he's one of the ones who resists the most the coming of the flood, I won't say too much, but because would love people to read the book.
People need to read the book for sure, because your writing is just so lyrical and so poetic, and these characters are so big, and the language is the kind of language, descriptive language, that one doesn't encounter often. These people are just like huge, and we know that they're, they hold so many more people within their own persons. You know, these characters, we know that they are not just individuals. We know that they're bigger than that. And, before we even hear that you know, you knew people, you met people that these characters grew from. But I was wondering if you could, oh man, I lost my thought. I was leading up to something. Shoot. but this relationship that Yali has with her grandfather is really wonderful. Oh yeah, I remember where I was going. And the grandfather, he's able to talk to the white folks because everyone doesn't necessarily have those diplomatic skills, and so they have to have someone that sort of speaks for the folks. And he's been one that's been able to, you know, sort of keep a diplomatic kind of peace between, you know, the folks.
Well, not the grandfather. No, actually, grandfather doesn't
grandfather?
Get along with wife. No, the grandfather doesn't get along
then?
With wife. Look, it's the grandfather's brother.
Oh, that's the brother? Okay.
Yeah, Tebow Manigault.
Oh,
right,
Tebow. Okay, gotcha.
The
okay.
two brothers. And again, I think, I mean, one of the things that I found, I mean, I grew up on the West Coast, and I had a very, you know, my view of the Deep South was, you know, family members who came back and talked about, you know, how bad it was there, and, you know, and I remember somebody saying one time, I wouldn't say get up to another mule if you got in bed with me. And, you know, I'm never going back. I mean, that's what I grew up hearing was I'm never going back there, and it's terrible. And then, of course, the civil rights movement began, and you began to see people, you know, getting beaten, and, you know, people like Jim Clark and the beatings on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, you know, and the marches and so forth. And so for me, I always thought that there was this, you know, very, you know, there was black on one side and white on the other side, and it was a very strict relationship, and, you know, you didn't cross over. And when I got to the South, I found out it was much more complicated than that, and that people, that there was, even within segregation, there was an enormous amount of maneuvering going on, and people sort of stretching the limits. And so there was negotiations where some people could talk and get by with some things. And so Tebow is one of the ones who's sort of a go-between mm-hmm. with white folks, and, you know, when there's trouble, to be able to sort of soothe things down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So hopefully our audience isn't too confused, and we didn't get a chance. We didn't talk about Ishii, who is, which I think Eshu when I think Ishii.
Well, actually, that's her. That's the basis of her name.
Okay.
Eshu is sort of a nickname, mm-hmm. but it comes from Eshu.
Okay.
And the names are, I mean, the Gullah names, for people who are not familiar with Gullah people, the Gullah names are all derived from African names. Mm-hmm. You know, Gullah people, the people of the book are not strictly Gullah. The Gullah people are essentially on the Sea Islands, just off of the coast of South Carolina, you know, from, so maybe Charleston down to Beaufort near Savannah. The people in my book exist a little bit inland, but they're based upon the Gullah. They're Gullah based. But so all of the names are African based, mm-hmm. and you can trace them back to Africa, all of the names of the people.
So what's Yali's name, since that's the nickname?
Now you ask me a question. Yella, Y-E-L-A, and if I don't have my, I can tell you if you give me a moment. There's a wonderful book called Africanisms in the Gullah Dialect, Lorenzo D. Turner.
Mm-hmm.
Who did this in, in the 1930s, he was the first scholar who connected African words in along the Sea Islands, the Gullah dialect, mm-hmm. and connected them directly to Africa. Mm-hmm. Before that, you know, people were sort of, you know, the feeling among linguists was that, you know, black people just didn't know how to talk. Or, you know, and that we were, you know, we borrowed things from Scotch or Irish or, you know, or we just made them up, and you know, we were just dumb and couldn't talk. And and what Dr. Turner did was take these words, and in many cases, I'm trying to look up Yali's name. Trace them back to the African roots. So it is enormously important book, and if anybody's a linguist, mm-hmm. you know, who's interested in that, I think it was reprinted by the University of South Carolina. So it's back in print.
Mm-hmm.
Yella is Mbundu. Or from the Mende, Mende, you know, coming from Sierra Leone,
mm-hmm.
To mean the one, or to be clean, or to be pure. So that's the origins of her name, but it's mm-hmm. Yella.
Right. And then we already know, because of other documentation, that the Africans in that region of the United States, through the type of agriculture that they were versed at, you know, the rice cultivation, that you could trace them back to Sierra Leone and the songs that they sang and things like that. There's a film, can't think of it right now, that links the two communities. And so I was wondering, in your research, was the names that you chose for your characters, were they connected? I mean, did you do that intentionally? Well, of course you did. You're a historian. you know, the names that you gave the folks in your novel were the names that, you know, their ancestors would have had, and you can trace that back, you know, to Africa, to that particular region, you know, Sierra Leone, and that particular area where you can see similar types of activities happening, you know, in different parts of the world through the generations. And
well, one of the things is we don't do enough study of the period of slavery. I mean, slavery, people used to call it the cotton curtain. That's drawn, it's almost like a veil that's drawn over slavery. And, you know, most of us can we know the names of our family members who came out of slavery. You know, most Black families can say, well, I know, you know, I've been a, you know, great aunt or great-great-grandmother, and we know she was from Texas or she was from Louisiana or Georgia, and we know her name, and she was in slavery, and she came out, and she lived, you know, until the 1940s or something. But once you get back into slavery, it's almost like a veil that's drawn over there, and we don't know much. There's only a few stories. There's almost no written record. But the thing is that that's the creation of the African-American people. And people should understand that before the period of slavery, there wasn't any. We didn't consider ourselves to be African. Africa, people in Africa didn't consider themselves to be members of one continent. I mean, you didn't have people who were in, say, you know, Algeria, who thought that they had some connection to people in Zimbabwe. Or in Southwest Africa, or in the Congo. I mean, they thought of themselves as members of a nation or as members of a tribe. And so the idea of a modern Africa is, and that some people could say that's Marcus Garvey's creation, the idea of Pan-Africanism and the idea that there's one Africa and there's one African culture is really a modern creation. So the thing is that in slavery, we took a very different people, the scattered people, and sort of funneled through the horrors of the Middle Passage and then into slavery. And somewhere in there was created the African-American people. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to do, we as African-American people, not relying on somebody else and hoping that somebody else will do the studies and then get mad when they don't do it right. We need to undertake those studies ourselves and say, who are we as a people? And the only way we can understand who we are as a people is to look at that period of slavery, because you had a scattered people, you had a very different people. One of the things was, you know, the cruelties of slavery was, American slavery was, to separate language groups, to separate religious groups so that people couldn't unite, so that they had to learn English, you know, to take away all of the culture, and you did that by not having the same groups. I just put that in that we need to do more of a study of that. And and some of the younger people especially need to look into that rather than trying to figure out, why do black people do this? And, you know, I don't understand. I mean, you're always seeing now on Facebook, some black person will say, I don't understand why black people do all this thing. Well, then study us and find out why, because the lessons are there, and the lessons are right in slavery, because that's the cooking ground. But one of the things, the peculiar things about South Carolina was, it's the area where it's amenable to rice growing. Mm-hmm. And in fact, some of the largest plantations, the richest plantations in the country, were rice plantations. It wasn't cotton plantations; mm-hmm. it was rice plantations, and that was on the South Carolina coast. And the planters, the slave masters, the slave owners who set that up, had no idea how to cultivate rice.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to do it, you know, but they didn't know how to do it. So what they did was they took people from Sierra Leone, because that's a rice-growing region. And so that's one of the few places where the ancestry of people was not broken up. So one of the reasons that the Gullah are a definable culture and a definable people is not only that they were isolated on the Sea Islands, but that most of them came from the Mende people and came from Sierra Leone. Mm-hmm. And they came there because they were rice-growing people. And so they were brought there because the growing of rice is almost, it's almost like an engineering feat. It's very different than regular agriculture. And that's one of the themes of the book, is that the people who are rice growers in my book, and the people that I knew there, look down on people who don't grow rice, because they know that the growing of rice is an engineering feat. I mean, you can't just put crops in the ground and then weed them and then come back and cultivate them. You've got to flood them at certain times, which means you have to have, I mean, people did this ingenious things where they had sluices and gateways where they would bring the seawater in or the fresh water in, and because you have to flood the fields at a certain part of the planting time, and then you have to take the water back out, and then you have to flood them again. So it's an engineering marvel, and you see some of the old fields. I mean, it's just it's an amazing part of agriculture. So again, that's why, you know, within the South Carolina especially, you have a very different kind of people than you have in some other parts of the country. But again, I just want to put a, you know, that this is something that we as African American people need to be studying ourselves.
Oh,
and to stop relying on other people. We do that so much. We get so mad and we say, oh, you know, well, the University of California, you know, they've got a black studies department, or they're doing something and they're not doing it right. Well, do it yourself.
Right. Well, you have certainly added to the canon with Sugary Rising. And since we're really out of time, but I have a couple of more questions, and David Roach is hanging out in the wings, in the green room, waiting for me to invite him in to talk about the Oakland International Film Festival, which kicked off yesterday.
Oh, wow.
On the anniversary of Martin King's 45th anniversary of his assassination.
I'm gonna go to the film fest. I'm gonna go to as many films as I can. So yeah, I don't want to stop that.
Yeah. But so I want to, you can hold your thought for a second. I wanted to ask you if you could talk. I'm trying to think. Let's see, what did I do with Lucy? I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about Yali's great aunt, who knows some things about, you know, why she's named what she's named, and some things about the family, and some things about her birth that her mother hasn't told her, which would clear some things up, because, you know, Yali's a, you know, young woman who's at that point where she's, like, not a child and she's not an adult. She's sort of, like, in that between space, which maybe is, maybe that's why she is sort of the conduit for this, for the spirits, the way she is, the way you have her working in the story, and how she's, you know, close to the elders. And she also has a step in the future, and she's, like, doesn't know what to do around this flood, and sort of looking at what the news of the dam construction is doing to her community, her family, and you know, I mean, it's all one family, you know, the community is so closely knit. So I was wondering if you could talk about her a little bit, and then I wanted to mention that Ishii, her big sister, gets married, and that's so that leaves a space in the house, but also leaves a space in Yali, because she was really close to her big sister, and Ishii is a really different type of woman, you know, sort of like her mother, because her mother, Yali's mother, when she decided to marry her husband, she married a man who was not a part of their community. He was from the other side, and he talks about how he never really belonged until they went on that journey, and they invited him to go on that journey down the river, which was really interesting and so exciting. Oh my goodness, people, you're gonna love it. So anyway, and then so you can talk about whatever of that you want, and.
Well, actually, you said it better than I could. I mean, I wrote it, but I think that you outlined a lot of it as good as I could. I would say one thing. The book, all the information about the book is available online. It's for sale. It's available at www.sugarerising.com. That's SUGARERISING, sugarerising.com. And information about where you can purchase it, you know, other information about the book is available there. I just, you know, I think that there, I mean, the book was written over a very, very long period of time, and it reflects a lot of the people I met within South Carolina, older spirits, the, you know, particularly, you know, Nauresa was one of the characters you talk about, the great aunt, is one of them. And the idea of, I guess, Yali is that this is common in a lot of cultures where people, you know, feel that older spirits are reborn in younger people. And Yali is one of those persons. And again, like a lot of us, she's in a peculiar position, and I won't say why, because that'll reveal some things in the book that gives people a lot of, you know. I mean, I think it's better, I guess I had an English teacher who used to tell me, if you have to walk around and explain what you've written, then you didn't write it well. So, you know, go back and write it better, and then you don't have to explain it. But I think there's the idea that we have people who feel a connection, an older connection. I mean, we have, you know, people in our family that we say they're little children, but they seem to have an understanding that surpasses their age. And you say that's just an old spirit. You know, and a lot of us say that about, you know, some of the younger people. And Yali is one of those persons who's a young spirit, but for peculiar reasons within the book, she doesn't get told that. And part of the story of Sugar Ray Rising is Yali's journey to understand what her real place is in the community and who she actually is. And again, it's one of the things, I mean, I wrote that in part for younger people. You have a lot of younger people who are just lost. I mean, we have these ways, we have these things that we do, we have these ways that we react. And, you know, you grow up in a society that in a lot of ways is not amenable to who you are and how you act and what you really want to be, and you're trying to fit yourself into it. And you realize that that may be because you're an older spirit who has come to do other things, and you've got another job. And I guess one of the things about Yali's journey is some of these things are hidden from her, and as a young person, she has to find out who she is. So, yes, you're right. There are a number of journeys within the book that people are taking, and it's in some ways it's like a mystery, which is why I don't, you know, like to reveal too much, because that's the fun of it.
Right.
Because there are mysteries that are revealed, and some of those you have to go back into the past to figure out. Some of those go out into the present to figure out.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
But again, it's www.sugaryrising.com, and any information people want to get about how to purchase it, it's available at some of the local bookstores. But all of those, you know, you can go to the links there, or you can go to all the traditional, you know, I don't want to name all of them, but, the, you know, it's available from all the major online retailers. So
right.
There's no excuses. If somebody really wants to read the book, they won't have a problem again.
Right. No, it is not out of print. It's still in its first printing.
Yes.
And, yeah, not for long.
And now it's, you know, we're in the new world. It's print on demand. So
we'll always be in its first printing. Okay.
Well, no, actually it won't. Because if you do a different, you know, you do a different edition. But the way print on demand works now, that, you know, they don't, it used to be that they print up a whole bunch of books and have them someplace and hope somebody buys them. Now it's, you know, the book sits in a computer program somewhere, and when you call and you say, well, I want that book, then they say, okay, and they print it right up. So,
right.
They're easy to get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, since we're so close to the top of the hour and people haven't even had a chance to even hear you read a little bit, I'm going to say, okay, David, hopefully you can hang on in there, because I'm like half an hour past the time I invited you to be on the show. But why don't you read, like, for maybe 2 or 3 minutes, and then I'll get David in for 9 o'clock.
Okay, I will do that. I will read an introduction to Yali,
okay.
Which is when, you know, we first see her, and some things about herself as a character.
Okay.
If some stranger had been sitting, hidden in the woods nearby, and had the sense to keep quiet while they watched her pass, they would have seen the very image of an Orisha stride by, so assured and content within itself and its growing young beauty and rising African womanhood, that it had no need to be concerned with the lack of self-acknowledgement or even self-awareness of those qualities by the girl herself. The Orisha Oshun, almost certainly, the spirit of rivers and all sweet water, Oshun, the rain to Shango's lightning, the proud and seductive Oshun, walking as she had in the days when Oludumare first made the world, with a flowing Angolan ease to herself, head high and level, arms swinging in loose rhythm from her wide shoulders, doe-fluid hips rotating seemingly unconnected to the strong straightness of her back. What had long been gangle was now sliding natural into grace. For herself, Yali Kinlaw saw none of that. She had long ago accepted herself as the skinny bitty in the family. Her brothers and Eshi and even Papa now and again had long ago set that in her mind in the jokey, boisterous way that was the Kinlaw's. Yali accepted it, and it did not bother her. each had a place in the Kinlaw family that was set and solid, and being the po' bones of the litter was hers. She kept her mind busy with other things. Today her mind was on the birds, and while she was away with them high up and flying far, her feet were like a good plow mule that carried her down the familiar way without her having to lead or even think about it. She could walk down to the rice fields blindfolded if she cared to, or in the deep of a moonless night without a lamp or torch, and never stumble on a root. She had walked this way so many times in her life.
Well, thank you, Jesse.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, this was a great conversation. I almost like feel like saying, okay, we need to talk again. We didn't get to everything.
Well,
but
you know, you know where to catch me.
Yeah, so I know we missed a reading last week. How did it go? And do you have any lined up for the rest, any time, any others this month, if April?
Phoenix Books in San Francisco last week, and that went well, which was the first reading in San Francisco. We planned a lot and did a lot, you know, during Black History Month, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of taking a break during, and we'll have some coming up soon. I don't want to say where because we're still in negotiations on dates and places, but
okay.
Probably going to move to some colleges.
Mm-hmm.
and some venues like that, libraries and things like that.
Okay, cool.
So I'll have some announcements pretty soon about what we'll be reading.
All right, okay. All right, well, thank you for the wonderful conversation, and thank you for the great book. Looking forward to another great book. Because this Sugary Rising is certainly a wonderful journey.
Thank you. And I'm going to listen to the rest of the show because I want to find out where to go to the film festival. Because
<All right.
laughs> I do not want to miss those films.
Okay,
and
cool.
People should not. So go to the films.
All right.
Okay.
All right, you take care.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Peace and blessings. Hey, David, how are you?
I'm very good, Wanda. How are you? Good.
Fine. Thank you so much for hanging in there and fitting us in your schedule. It's like, oh, man, we haven't even had a chance to talk to David about the film festival, and it started.
Oh, wow. It started last night.
I know. How did it go?
Oh, it was very exciting. Very exciting evening. Still kind of reflecting on the night.
Okay.
Today.
Oh, reflect out loud.
Okay. Well,
Let me tell folks first, this is David Roach, who is the founder, I don't know if you're co-founder, but you're definitely the only founder I know, of the Oakland International Film Festival that is having its 11th anniversary, right?
That's right, yes.
Yeah.
Here. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and I was just reading, and I hadn't known this before, which I thought was pretty cool, you know, sort of the history of the festival, how, you know, your filmmaking artistic brothers, you know, your family.
That's right.
You know, you why don't you tell us that story? It'd be better than my reading it. Why don't you tell us sort of how the Oakland International Film Festival came into being? Because that's a really fascinating story. And then tell us about, you know, opening night, and tell us about, you know, the pre-festival kickoff in South San Francisco. And this.
Wow, that's a lot to talk about.
Well, we got 30 minutes.
Yeah,
then,
well, I mean, I don't know if I can do it in that order, but,
any order you
know,
you like.
Okay, well, you know, it really all started because being, you know, born in the Bay Area, San Francisco, and having older brothers who were, you know, we grew up with, my mother was pretty active in the movement with, you know, different folks that were always at our house making the garments for Dr. King and growing up with Panther posters on my wall and you know, posters of Africa on my wall and Hannibal on the back of an elephant and just really, you know, creating the confidence that whatever that we put our mind to, that we could achieve it. And so that was instilled early in my life. My oldest brother was a great example. You know, he's the chief of staff at UC San Francisco Hospital. And, you know, growing up in San Francisco, he just really, you know, led in education, that we all should be educated in whatever, you know, field that we so choose. My mother being a teacher, my father being in business for himself, there's a certain amount of independence that we, you know, we all have. And then my older brother, Paul, studied theater at ACT in San Francisco. And I, you know, recall him just being in drama and just studying the art form. And so, you know, he was he directed a stage play called Tunnel Like It Is that went on national tour. Mm-hmm. And he had a script that he had written called Sydney Bird Private Eye. And so, you know, after seeing all these years of his work and helping out other directors and writers become successful, he had worked with Mario Van Peebles of New Jack City, you know, and it was just the timing was perfect to, you know, follow up on his own script. And so that sort of led into, you know, after making the film, Sydney Bird, Private Eye, we actually got into different film festivals and, you know, nothing like taking care of your home first. So coming back to Oakland and, you know, with all this energy of being at Sundance and, you know, the Pan-African Film Festival in LA and just seeing how this was an opportunity for us to showcase our work, which is very difficult for many independent filmmakers because we typically put everything we can into making the film, but you make the film for people to see your film. So it's very, you know, cost a lot to rent theaters and to, you know, market people to come and see your film. But being a part of a film festival, it helps. Once you're selected into a festival, it kind of validates that your film is at a certain level and people should come and see it.
Mm-hmm.
So we just marketed our film, you know, in other festivals and you know, people came out to see it. And as we're growing over the years, we've been growing to, you know, become a channel for other filmmakers, you know, and it's been a rewarding experience.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So why did you decide to have, this year, I don't think mm-hmm. I've seen the Oakland International Film Festival in so many places. You're in so many cities. You're in San Leandro. You're in Berkeley. You're in Oakland. Like I said, you kicked it off in South San Francisco. And, of course, you know, you're in Oakland in a few venues. So, yeah, mm-hmm. talk about this year, how, you know, you're really large, and you mentioned that your mother, she sewed garments for Dr. King, and so you kicked off the festival on this historic day, and you're a historian as well as, you know, economist and teacher. I remember when I first met you, you were teaching at McClymonds High School, and that's where you kicked off the Mobetta Foods and the farmers, Black Farmers Market, and you have the Urban Garden, you know, with Ms. Shakur, and
mm-hmm.
I mean, you're also connected to the Black fraternity because you went to historically Black college, and like you're just all over the place and doing so well in all these different ventures. I mean, yeah. So anyway, and then you have children. You have a wonderful wife.
Yes, I do. I have a son and a daughter who are, you know, so beautiful. That's a blessing to have, you know, children, of course, as you do. Your daughter, whenever I see you two together, I'm like, wow, that's beautiful, you know. I feel very blessed to, as I said earlier, you know, to have a stronger foundation than what my parents had. You know, my father grew up with a house that leaned on a pole to stand up in Texas, and he worked half the year as a sharecropper, and the other half was pretty much, you know, in school, but you couldn't stay in school because they had to, you know, pay rent and pay for livelihood. And so, you know, I feel that, you know, when you read about people like, you know, some of the works that the Brother Turner, that you just had on the air, I really am appreciative to hear, to be on the line and just listen to you two talk about, you know, South Carolina and about, that's where my family comes from, you know, mm-hmm. from a place called Petey River, near Petey River, mm-hmm. you know, in South Carolina. And my great auntie who passed away maybe about 10 years ago, but when she was about 106 at one of our family reunions, I said, Aunt Ella, you may help you get something to eat? She said, well, I can get up and get it myself. You know, and so, but we have that kind of, you know, strength in our roots, and we've overcome so much where, you know, the obstacles that are present, you kind of look beyond that. You stay focused on where it is you want to go. And as you mentioned, you know, these various things that I've been working on over the years, I wake up every day feeling like I haven't made it yet. I haven't gotten there yet, you know, because that place is what, I feel that place is what our ancestors sang in their spirituals, you know, and that's where I'm focused on. So these are all different tools. Film is a tool, you know. Of course, food, we all need it, and it's a way of building a sustainable community. You know, once you feed yourself, all the jobs you can create, you know, your diet's better, your health is better. So, you know, and these are nothing. You know, these are things that are not new. As you talked about the rice fields in South Carolina, it actually. The rice was so sustainable, you know, in comparison to other regions where slavery, you know, you have the tobacco fields in Virginia where you can't eat tobacco, but you can eat rice, mm-hmm. you know, and you can't eat cotton, but you can't eat rice. And so so by having that sustainable type of crop, our populations were able to grow, where other regions, We were, you know, like I said, you can't eat them. So I forgot the term, but we would, you know, we would die easier, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, what do you call it? The turkey matriculation rate. What is that word called? Of when people pass away at a certain rate. What's the word? I'm still kind of coming back from my event last night, so I'm a little slower. But whenever you have a rate, the mortality rate was lower in South Carolina because of the fact that we had a staple as the base of slavery. You see what I'm saying? And so we could at least feed ourselves. So even though the master, you know, was doing what they were doing, you know, you can't eat the tobacco. So my point is this: is that, you know, it's really knowing the engineering, you know, knowing that Dr. Carver and all these great people, you know, existed before, and they did and had all these 300 plus inventions from the peanut, and you know, 118 or so from the sweet potato, you know, and to think that he did all this. Mm-hmm. In times of you know, I mean, really, even though slavery was abolished, as you know, Thaddeus Stevens said when it was one of the congressmen at the time, is that, you know, what do you mean? We're about to release 40 million slaves without a cent in their pocket, without a hut to live in, mm-hmm. you know. So even though he was born in slavery, and you know, became the first, you know, to receive a master's in agriculture out of Iowa State, you know, the times were still very much similar to slavery, mm-hmm. you know. And so anyway, I'm just to say that with all that history, as Brother Turner was talking about, you know, that we need to seek out and find for ourselves, mm-hmm. those roots help really make that tree grow, you know. And I feel very blessed to have these roots that, you know, let us know that really it's not about what they are doing for us. It's more about what we are doing for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly.
Yeah.
And your film festival, you know, as I mentioned earlier, it's in mm-hmm. so many different places.
Yes.
I mean, last year you were, I think you were primarily at the Oakland Museum.
We were, right. Right.
Which made it so easy. But this time, oh, my goodness, well, you're at Black Rep. You're at a venue in San Leandro that I don't know, but I'm going to learn about. You're in Chinatown, right. Oakland's Chinatown, at that wonderful hall, auditorium, which I've been in before.
That's right. The Oakland Asian Cultural Center. Uh-huh.
Yeah, wonderful space.
We'll be there today, all day
right.
today.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. So tell us about you know, your offerings, and then you've got films about some really controversial figures in our history. You know, like the president of Zimbabwe, and I'm like, oh, that looks really good. And then you've got these great panels where people can actually listen and talk to the filmmakers about making their films, and particularly like documentary filmmakers, as well as feature filmmakers and shorts. You always have the educational component in there.
Well, you know, and some of that is being, you know, privileged to attend other film festivals, because Sundance has, you know, a lot of panels and workshops, and filmmakers come together and they share, you know, what they do, and so some of those ideas, you know, and then also the American Black Film Festival, they have a number of panels that they host, and like I said, you know, just really seeing these kind of things and just saying, hey, why don't we do that in Oakland, you know, and so, you know, and so it's really about, and as you add, you know, you were talking about all the different venues, and a big part of, for example, last night we were, you know, at the Grand Lake Theater, and around the corner there's a Cuban spot called Kanya, the restaurant, and it's actually owned by one of my Morehouse brothers, Yusuf, one of the co-owners, and so it's right around the corner, and so we created this film lounge there. And so the filmmakers, we had, you know, the backdrop with all of our sponsors and logos, and people love taking pictures, you know, with the film festival branding. And you know, we see this as an opportunity to really, for his business, I mean, he actually did very well because of the festival. And so there's a way where oftentimes I think the art are looked upon as, you know, those artists are just over there and frivolously spending money. They want to write something. They're going to be poor. You know, they don't really have they can't really do anything for anybody, you know. But part of our reason for having it at his place, and also the Black Repertory Theater, which has been in existence for, I don't know, maybe 50 years or so, you know, is to really figure out how we can make that connection, where the arts can improve the community as well, where we can use education as a vehicle to, you know, boost small venues, small business. So then it becomes a win-win for everybody. And as you mentioned, the film Mugabe, villain, our hero, the filmmaker Roy, you know, flew in from London. He left this morning. As I first talked to you on the phone, I was just dropping off Kavita Smith, who is, you know, Bernie Mac's wife, in the, you know, in the film, I guess, what is it called, Bernie Mac Show. And she was, you know, grew up here in the Bay Area and happened to be a part of my brother's first play, Tell 'Em Like It Is. And so he kind of got her started in the, you know, in acting, in the business. And so there's all these people that are connecting, and now our festival is now being seen in Zimbabwe because of the filmmaker in Zimbabwe. Today's we were just in the press in China because of the film that we're showing today called Let's Fall in Love, which is an amazing documentary about Miss Chen, who is a matchmaker in Taiwan. And so she actually will set people up and tell you, well, you've been dating her for 3 years, what's wrong with you? Why don't you marry her? What kind of qualities? So she's getting younger people to marry. And it's not always the best situation, which the documentary shows. But if you're in a relationship and you're considering one, or if you've been through one, it's a really funny, you know, fun piece to really look at, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one that, you know, but because we are an international film festival, it's enabling us to create a direct connection to, you know, other communities beyond the borders. As you mentioned, our kickoff was last week in San Francisco. We had a mixer with, you know, the film Rice Field of Dreams director Darren Kerr, who was from Cambodia. And it was really special to be within, you know, the Cambodian community of, you know, the folks who showed up and to meet his parents. And you know, and I feel very honored to meet these filmmakers who are telling these amazing stories, which oftentimes will not make, you know, mainstream media because, as you mentioned, the Mugabe film,
mm-hmm.
you know, is about a very controversial figure, Robert Mugabe, who, you know, has been in leadership since the independence of Zimbabwe, you know, which was formerly known as Rhodesia, and decided that now that the country was independent, that the resources of that country should be turned over to the Zimbabwe people. And those Zimbabwe people being the black people who have been colonized, you know, in that region. And so, so of course, the Western world is not going to like that because they've, you know, been benefiting from the resources of Zimbabwe, as, you know, a lot of Africa in general. And, but, you know, we have to look at things from what's best for us, you know, what's best for our family, for our community. And, you know, we have to see clearly that, you know, it's like what Malcolm X said years ago, where I have this quote, I may not have it exact, but during, you know, during the move for Brown versus Board of Education and all this, he said, well, you fools, how would you let your children be taught by your oppressors?
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, and so when you understand that we've been oppressed and that we've been, the media has used propaganda to define us as not intelligent, as Mr. Turner said on your, you know, about language, you know, how black people speak, as he was talking about it.
Yes.
You know, how we sound stupid, you know. But if you look at anybody from any country who speaks to you, you're going to hear their dialect and their voice, you know. But they can get away with it because their country has, you know, that's their country. If, you know, if they're from Ireland, they got a little Irish accent. If they're from, you know, and if they're from, like, my friends from Cambodia, they speak, you know, they speak Cambodia, but they speak English, but they have certain words they might leave out. But I understand what they're talking about, and I would dare not call them, you know, stupid for not, you know, speaking the English language in the you know, in the way that you know, that I've been raised to speak it. So anyway, just to say that the film festival is really, you know, we're really looking at how we can allow these stories that oftentimes would not be seen, you know, to have a channel, and it's a journey. I mean, like I said, we're not really there yet. The vision is really for it to be the Oakland International Film Festival, for the whole city of Oakland. Have different venues that are paying attention to the filmmakers. We're right now. I'm at the Oakland Airport, and I'm dropping off a bunch of programs here to be dispersed at the airport.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and we really need all. I mean, we need all these different organizations to understand that this can be a win-win for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so yeah.
Yeah. So, so today you're going to be at the Renaissance Center Plaza all day, you said?
No, today we're going to be at the Oakland Asian Cultural Center.
Oakland Asian Cultural Center,
I'm going to be there. And then we're also going to be from 5 to 9. We're going to host a little mixer at Fa's Restaurant from
mm-hmm.
5 to 9. So they're going to provide, you know, a lot of food, free food for the filmmakers and the public to come through. So, and we're going to have some interviews there taking place with filmmakers at 5, which is about 3 blocks away from the museum.
Okay.
And, you know, they wanted to come in. You know, they did it last year with us, and they enjoyed connecting with the filmmakers, and they enjoyed the exposure that we're able to, you know, have through our website and the marketing of the festival. And that's what I'm talking about. There's a benefit that, you know, that we've seen at film festivals that can, I mean, I think Sundance makes a, I think it was $100 million or something over 10 days to boost that economy.
Wow.
You know, and so we can, you know, we can do better in those, you know, and,
yeah. David, let me interrupt you because I want you to talk some more about the films. So I know you always have at its centerpiece films that are made by Oakland directors. And I know you have – and also you always, because of your own, you know, values and philosophical home, you always have films about sustainability and about food and about health. And you've got some really interesting films around the greening of our community and about urban gardeners and things like that. And I was wondering if you could maybe just tell us about some of those, the Oakland filmmakers or directors that you're highlighting this year, and as well as some of your environmental films. And is any other, you know, of course, all the films are your favorites, but any other, you know, big films, and some of your films I notice are screening more than once, which is really, really great. Thank you so much for having multiple screenings of some of these great films, because I know sometimes if you miss it, you have really missed it.
Yeah, we wanted to make sure people had, knowing that we're all working very hard to keep a roof over our heads, so we don't, you know, we want to give people a different, you know, another opportunity to actually see the film.
Mm-hmm.
A Wild Idea, we're screening tonight, and I really would start there.
Okay.
Because it was made in Ecuador,
mm-hmm.
and it speaks to the president. I forgot his name right now, but he actually went to the UN. There's an area there that is, I think it has more, this area of Ecuador has never been modernized. It's still where you can find all of the, I don't say all, but in any place on the globe, it has not been touched for the most part. So this whole region, but they've already found that there's a bunch of oil there, you know, to be extracted, and they could really boost their local economy from you know, pulling this oil out. But the cost of that would be so detrimental to the whole globe, you know, for our whole ecosystem. And so the wild idea that he had was, knowing the country has a lot of economic issues, he asked the UN to pay them to not drill.
Mm, wow.
So that we could actually preserve, you know, Mother Earth,
mm-hmm.
I want to tell you how things have come out with it, but he's gotten a lot of support, and he's also been, you know, criticized for, mm-hmm. You know, for this particular idea that they call it a wild idea in this particular documentary film, mm-hmm. and that's the connection. I think it's a global thing. One of the films we're going to be screening is called Delicious Peace, which is a film out of Uganda, which talks about a co-op that's in Uganda called Delicious Peace. It's a coffee company that they started, and it's growing. They're being able to now employ folks from the village to work with this company and to create their own, you know, economy from coffee, which typically is owned by, you know, bigger companies. The film 16 Seeds is Melinda James. She's an open filmmaker. It's a short film, and it actually, she's interviewing people like Gail Myers, who's doing a farm program in San Francisco, and two other sisters who are, you know, into urban gardening and preserving and saving their seeds, you know, to plant again in the, you know, next season. And the 16 seeds is what she uses as a title here to symbolize that the 16 seeds, you can basically feed an entire nation. You know, once you plant those plants, they'll grow, they'll bring new seeds, and then your whole nation keeps growing. And so that documentary we're showing a couple of times as well. Corner Garden is a program that was started by the East Oakland Boxing Association, where they have a garden there, and they're just showing all these, you know, youth who are getting involved with growing their own food and how food insecure they've been over the years, and how, you know, as I said, food insecure, you know, meaning they have a lack of access to fresh fruits and vegetables in this community, and so they're growing their food and they're learning about, you know, really taking care and being proud of what they grow and what they're, you know, the whole process. It's amazing when, you know, as you mentioned, we have you've been over to the garden at Claremont back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing how children, when you experience the feeling, like when you see them see what they planted actually grow, they go, look what I did. Look what I planted. Look what I did, you know. And it's like, well, you planted the seed, but you know, you can't take the responsibility for doing everything. I mean, you know, the soil was connected to it, the air, you know, the water, you know, the rain came, you know. But there's a certain type of when you plant that seed and it grows, it kind of resembles, you know, like I said earlier, confidence in life, knowing that I can do something. Wow, this is perfect. So when you see that plant come out and it shoots out off the ground, it's in perfection, you know. And there's a way where you kind of pick up, you know, this film in a corner garden. You can just see the excitement that children have with a simple garden, you know. I'm trying to think of some other sustainable films that really reach out.
What about there's one that has, it's like about it's a profile, I think. And I thought it was about a woman who was perhaps an environmentalist. I can't remember the name of the film, and I don't know if it was a short or not.
Okay, she's an environmentalist. Okay,
I thought she was about Mama C. Yeah.
Mama C.
Oh, definitely. Well, Mama C. That's another one. But yeah, talk about Mama C.
Uh-huh.
That was in the Pan African Film Festival, and I'm so happy you're bringing it up here.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah, Mama C. Sister Charlotte O'Neill, who actually was a Panther from Kansas, and she's been in Tanzania for I guess maybe 50 years, 40 years now.
Yeah, a long time.
And just the film just goes into her transitioning, you know, from pretty much urban life into, you know, the rural Tanzania and the community that she's built there and you know, the people that she has connected with.
Mm-hmm.
And it just shows another side of her, an artistic side of her, her music, her you know, her art. And just that, you know, I think that's part of it, that, you know, there's a way where you can be an artist, you can be a painter, you can be a songwriter, you can sing, you can, you know, where people are very, you know, how people say, well, who are you? Like, what do you do? You know, you meet somebody, say, well, what do you do? You know, people are usually asking you, how do you make your money?
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't always define what you do, who you are, you know. And I think that's one thing that she shows in this film, is that as much as she's been an activist all these years and been working to, you know, create a Pan-African connection and developing, you know, sustainable communities, at the same time, she's a human being who enjoys, you know, songs and drumming and you know, and painting and creating art and, you know, and different things like that. And so, you know, different forms of expression, you know, artistic expression. And so it's a nice piece. It's a, you know, it shows at the San Leandro Performing Arts Center on, I believe, Saturday during the day. And we have I think we have that film showing with another film called 41st and Central.
Oh, yeah. What's that about?
41st and Central is about, often it's overlooked, the story about the Black Panther Party in Los Angeles, and how it came about, and it touches on the development of gangs in Los Angeles, and which was in some cases large cases of in reaction to the white gang when we migrated to Los Angeles from the South.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is very interesting because, you know, as you, you know, a lot of folks will run out of the South.
Mm-hmm.
My stepfather was, my mom told me that he was run out of the South.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, I guess he had a job somewhere and you know, somebody called him nigga or sonny or something. And he responded to a white man like, hey, I know you're not talking to me or something. And the word got back to his mother, where he had tongue, and they knew that he was going to have visitors very soon after. And so they put him on a bus, and he came out to Los Angeles to live with his grandmother. And but what you find in this is that a lot of us were, you know, we had to leave the South because we had done something, you know, in the South that was not acceptable. But when we arrived in Los Angeles, then we were pretty much, they had a Ku Klux Klan mentality here.
Mm.
And they used to have different, you know, white gangs that would beat up folks in the community. So black folks started creating gangs. And those gangs were in to really defend their community to a large extent. And so when the Panthers came around in the 60s, it made sense for many of them to join the Panther Party, to be a part of that organization, because they already had that sort of maroonage type of spirit of defending ourselves and protecting our community and really being ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a certain kind of culture of that you will find, you know, even in our youth today that we might look at with the pants sagging and the tattoos and the locks and people say, look at that. Well, what are you doing? You don't get no job, you know. And the thing is that, you know, there's a certain kind of identity when he's trying to say, we're not looking at just a job. We're looking at being who we are. And I think that's part of what you will find in this particular film. The story of Bunchy and, you know, having this, you know, leadership ability was amazing in this particular film, 41st and Central. Elaine Brown and Bunchy and I think it was John Huggin,
mm-hmm.
were actually killed at UCLA campus.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about the relationship between the Panthers and the US organization. And, you know, it's a very powerful, it's about 2-hour documentary. I mean, it's a pretty, you know, it's a great, Gerald Everett's supposed to be here, the filmmaker as well, which is a big part of this festival. You know, like you mentioned Mugabe last night, just hanging out with Roy, you know, the filmmaker who's from Ghana, who made this film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's amazing. It's just a big part of it. You know, having filmmakers here to talk to. About their film, how they made their film, why they're telling the story. And Gerald told this particular story because he grew up with his father being a Panther, and he didn't know all the things that were going on,
mm-hmm.
you know, and why he was out so much, you know, working in the movement.
And there's
another film that from an Oakland filmmaker, he's a student at UCLA, called Against the Grain.
Mm-hmm.
Which it's a narrative piece, original script that he wrote. Received some awards for it. I think it won one of the best features, or you know, one of the categories in the Pan African Film Festival. I know it won an award in the Hollywood Black Film Festival. He just returned from another festival. I forgot the name of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it tells the story of a young brother growing up in Oakland who has his mind set on becoming a doctor and getting out of the hood in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, he has this past of his partners and, you know, he deals with folks who he finds out are jealous of him. He finds out that, you know, he's always questioning, is he leaving what we might call, you know, being real, you
mm-hmm.
know, to pursue his actual dream, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's a good story. I mean, it's a really good film. The film, we show a film called Licks last night, which
mm-hmm.
you know, sold out, and it was amazing to see the Grand Lake Theater just packed to the, you know, you got to turn people away for the film. But it was a shot in Oakland. It was in the South by Southwest Film Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it tells a story of this young brother who you know, made some bad choices and is incarcerated. But then as he returns back to his community, he's still confronted with the same things that caused him to do the crime in the first place. But now he you know, he has that case on his record. Now he
right.
has to adapt, you know. And so,
yeah. But, David, we are so out of time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
My other guest,
okay.
she's
thank you.
Popped into the studio and then popped out, and I don't know if
I don't want
to keep her waiting any longer.
Okay, well, are you coming to the film?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay, so just come to the press pass. We got a press pass for you, so I hope to see you soon.
Okay, super. Yeah, and give the website and the phone number for the festival so people can call and find out where you all are.
Okay. Yeah, just Oakland International Film Festival.com.
Okay, that's easy.
Okay,
and then any phone number, like hotline number they can call?
Let's see. We have a line too. It's on our website. So it's all there. It's on our website. I don't have it in front of me right
okay.
now. It's like 888-494 something. I forgot 2964 something like that.
Okay, I'll look it up
we'll
and I'll announce it for you.
Okay, thank you so much. All right. Have a beautiful day. Hope to see you later. Okay.
Oh yeah, you too,
right.
David. Keep up the great
right.
work. I'm looking
thank
forward
you.
To the film festival this year.
thank you so much, Wanda.
All right.
You too.
Be
take care. Bye bye. All right.
Peace.
Bye.
Still I Rise by Maya Angelou.
Yes, it's beautiful.
Yeah. And I was wondering, tell us about that particular song. And she's coming to town on April 13th. She's going to be at Yoshi's in Oakland. And an 8 o'clock and a 10 o'clock show. And the dance floor is going to be open. And
we've
got three pairs of tickets to give away. But, yeah, tell us about I Look Good. And then I'm going to read your bio. And then we can start talking about your wonderful work.
Well, that particular song was a remix of I Look Good, which many many bands have covered the song, but it's just really a song about self-love and positivity and loving yourself. I wrote that regarding, you know, just empowering, especially women, you know, in times like this. That's what Climax was about and still is about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a real provocative name, Climax.
K-L-Y-M-A-X-X-X. Yes, we had to make it our own, so I came up with that spelling, but it's exciting.
So Climax presents Bernadette Cooper Diva and a Turntable Tour, And the Steve Ivory Review Climax, the legendary platinum-selling all-female band, is synonymous with such chart hits as The Men All Pause, Meeting in the Ladies' Room, Sexy, I Still Say Yes, Divas Need Love Too. Oh, do they?
Yes, we do.
Yeah, yes, and the band's biggest hit, the popular 5 Billboard single, I Miss You. And when you think
very popular.
Yeah. And when you think of the groundbreaking pop R&B funk unit, you can't help but also think of its founding leader, musician, writer, and producer, Bernadette Cooper, who is joining us right now on the air. Yeah, thank you so much for being with us and hanging in there.
Thank you for inviting us.
Oh, this is really exciting. An all-female band, and your band is in, you are inventive and charismatic, and you embody climax. Your audacious attitude, the intuitive comedic timing, your inspirational dissertations on the love of self, the irony by design, it all serves to forge the fierce, funky, and fabulous diva experience that is climax's entertaining, enduring renown. As a solo artist, you have a critically acclaimed album, Drama, according to Bernadette Cooper, and it features the top 5 single, I Look Good, which we just played a little bit of, which iconic entertainer Betty Midler proudly adopted as the opening theme for a popular Diva Las Vegas tour. With the multifaceted Cooper, making music for climax or your solo interest, you are finding and developing new talent, often from the group from the ground up, as you did with Madam X, handpicking members of the girl group and writing and producing their hit, Just That Type of Girl. Halle Berry's attempt to emulate you was by far one of Saturday Night Live's best comedic episodes. How long ago was that?
That was probably a few years ago. She did it on Saturday Night Live. It was fabulous.
Nice.
You know, I was very honored. And they did it. It was actually the entire group, and they mocked us and did a very, very good job.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it.
Yes. That's great. And now the ever-evolving Bernadette unveils her latest musical adventure, Climax, presents Bernadette Cooper's Diva and a Turntable. So tell us about Diva and a Turntable and this new musical adventure that you are bringing to Oakland.
It is my new Frankenstein, if I can say something. My new invention, as I'm constantly trying to reinvent. It's really an extension of Climax. Climax is touring. I tour with them at times, but this is a love of mine that I wanted to develop. And it's pretty much taking the songs that I wrote and produced within Climax, which are most of the songs, Menopause, and I'd like to do with vocal parts and Meeting in the Ladies' Room, and Just That Type of Girl from Madam X, Bette Midler, all these things that I was involved in writing. Excuse my voice is a little scratchy. Mm-hmm. I was involved in writing and being a part of, and the drama of it all is a part of this show. It's just a smaller version of the concept, something a little bit more accessible for people to see in clubs and enjoy the music and keep the positive music flowing. That's what's important. So
right.
Just an extension of Climax, and people are going to love it. It's a very, very exciting show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so who are the members of the group?
Well, I am the only member of the group. It's just me. And
oh.
I have a few people performing with me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so who are you bringing?
Who am I bringing along? What are their names?
Yeah, uh-huh.
One of the girls' names is Kiki Kite, who is absolutely fabulous. She's a drummer as well as a vocalist, dancer.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have Mara Washington, who's DJ Carmen Camille. She's my DJ, and I also bring a drummer in, Cheryl Harper.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of kick booty. We're really, really good. I have to say that.
Yeah. So this whole concept of, you know, having all female band and, you know, having music that's real empowering, you know, to women, to girls, to listeners. I mean, it's the lyrics are catchy, as well as positive. And it's sort of like, I don't know, it seems like you have sort of, with your group and, you know, with your music, sort of carved out a space that doesn't exist. I mean, it's like there are women, you know, well, I don't know of any all-women bands, not that many. So are you like sort of a trailblazer here and you're continuing to carry that flame? Do you see where the torch has, you know, ignited other similar types of artistic ventures?
I would love to consider myself as a trailblazer, you know, and I'm continuing my mission, which is to just do what I do, and that is create music and be involved in projects that are positive and create excitement within the music industry. I love shocking and pleasing and being a part of anything new. No, there hasn't been any concept like Climax. I mean, we started the group. Climax started in the 80s, and here we are, 2013. There has not been another female group band that has existed with the attitude and the vibe and women playing instruments like Climax. So I see the opening, I see the hole. So I'm just kind of jumping in and creating scenarios where they should exist. So that's what I'm pretty much doing.
Are you from Southern California? Where did this artistic fervor, you know, where was it nurtured? Where did it grow from?
It was definitely was born in Los Angeles, California.
Okay.
That's where I grew up all my life.
Mm-hmm.
Moved to New York and I stayed there for like 10 years, and then moved back recently. Within the last 5 to 7 years, I'm back in LA. So Los Angeles, California is my home, most definitely so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell us something about, you know, those sort of early days, you know, how you got started, and particularly since, you know, it's kind of difficult to be the first. so how, you know, sort of how did you, you know, sort of how were you nurtured, or, you know, what support did you get for this, you know, idea to have the kind of music that you have become really well known for, you know, as the type of work that you wanted to share with others?
A lot of great musicians and very talented musicians. I have studied in the church, and I am, you know, a part of that crew where I started in the church. My father was a minister, so I started playing drums in the church. So that's where I began to realize, wow, I love this. He brought me a drum set. Love this. So continued on to school, and my love for music just would not go away. Went to college a couple years and decided, and I realized what my passion was, and I really, really wanted to be connected with music somehow. I had no idea how this was going to happen, but I had a very strange, I had a very large desire to create a band, and I wanted to create a female band. So where it came from, I'm not quite sure, you know, but the love of it and the idea of it and the desire made me quite aggressive in pursuing. So I started, I actually put my studies on hold, and then I began, through newspaper ads and word of mouth, I began trying to find these girls. So I went through a series of girls until I finally came up with the crew that exists now, the Climax, that became very, very popular. So I think it was just a part of my mission, because I really don't have a very clear understanding on how or why I started out on this mission, other than the fact that it was my desire and it was my passion.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about how, you know, about your creative process, you know, how you came up with, you know, these songs that are now sort of standards.
Yeah, it's great how the years have passed, decades have passed.
Mm-hmm.
And these songs are still very, 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 very in the marketplace, they're very, very powerful and very empowering, especially for women, you know, because we need a little empowering, you know, as far as just learning to love ourselves more. So that was my focus in writing these songs. They came about, really, to be honest with you, we were like consummate musicians. Mm-hmm. And when Mr. Dick Griffey signed us, he saw the potentials. He sold our records, MCA. He saw the potential, and he put us in the studio. He signed us, gave us a record deal. And we just were in the studio night and day. He put us in the studio with guys as producers. So we kind of went along with what they wanted us to do, what they wanted us to say, but we knew it wasn't us. We knew we weren't going to be running home from work to cook dinner and rub feet. We knew we wanted to get out and be career women and to get out and be fashionable and to really, really have fun. So Mr. Griffey recognized this because he would be around us. He would take us out to dinner all the time. So he would notice our lingo and the way that we would talk and communicate about the things we loved. So he said, you know what? You girls are going to be a part of your next album. So we just pretty much put our own personal personality. You know, I'm always walking around the studio saying, I know I look good. I know I'm fabulous. So I just pretty much transferred that onto Wax.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what our biggest hit was derived from, which is The Menopause. That was the number one hit.
Right. Oh, wow. That's really fascinating. So could you say that in some way the music is like is the story of your life?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It is the story of my life, you know. I look back now at a lot of things, and, you know, when I write some personal experiences, you know, that may it be negative, may it be positive. I write about the things that I'm feeling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of times we create these alter egos when we're not feeling good about ourselves or members in your family or people around you don't feel good about yourself. So you create this superwoman. And that superwoman, I would say, is a part of writing, I look good. I know I was looking good. Slap me because I know I'm looking good. All of that, you know, and I really believe, my alter ego really believes that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
yeah.
So yes, I do write about things I feel and I am involved in.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Huh. So if you started, you know, the group, you know, in the 1980s, and here we are in 2013. I was wondering, you know, sort of when you reflect, you know, on your legacy and what you've contributed to, you know, to the discourse around, you know, women and art. And you see sort of where women and artists are now. It's like, okay,
mm-hmm.
You're like an elder. Not elder physically, maybe, you know, sort of chronologically, but definitely, you know, people need to pay their respect. You opened some ground. You know, you laid the foundation for a whole lot of folks.
I believe that. I believe
mm-hmm.
that.
Yeah.
You know, I graciously accept that. I'm humbled.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
I'm humbled by it all. But
definitely.
I'm humbled by it. But I recognize it.
Mm-hmm.
I recognize it. And, you know, I'm cool. I'm cool about it.
Mm-hmm.
I continue to help people and to continue to help and bring people into the fold. And, yeah, and, you know, I am definitely a veteran in this business, but I'm still sexy. Still sexy.
Oh, yeah,
that's
of course.
The most important part. It's the most important part. I'm sexier
right.
now than I was then.
Yeah. So I was wondering, you know, sort of when you look at, you know, sort of like your artistic children, you know, so who comes to mind? And then when you think... You're thinking of yourself as, you know, sort of a part of a lineage, a creative lineage, you know, sort of who do you look back on, you know, as an artist, you know, were there any artists, women artists, or even, yeah, women artists maybe perhaps that you might say that they, you know, might have inspired you, or even within your own family, you know, women that might have inspired you to have that kind of self-confidence. That you you know, embody in your work?
I look back and I think that I know my musical heroes. I couldn't help but have certain musical heroes because my mother would play these albums over and over again. Mm-hmm. And the one that comes to mind would be Aretha Franklin.
Mm-hmm.
My mother played her when she was happy. My mother played her when she was sad. My mother played Aretha Franklin and a lot of other music. But the one thing that comes to mind, if you notice in some of my past albums, I thank her because her musical sensibility and her singing and her arranging and her phrasing really guided the way that I approach music, and that's usually with perfection.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
I can't think of, right at the top of my head, let me see.
Yeah.
Right at the top of my head, it would be Aretha. Of course, I was in the era of Angela Davis, which was the first really strong woman empowerment movement that I was connected to as far as, visually seeing and understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure there's many more. It's just morning. My brain is just starting to work.
Yeah, it's kind of early for an artist. Yeah. Thank you so much for doing this at this time.
Oh, no problem. No problem. I was up to 3:30 in the studio, and I'm like, oh, I got to get up. But I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. Wow. So I was thinking maybe we'll play another one of your songs and talk a little bit more. So I'm going to play, because they're all, if you don't mind, because these pieces are, your songs are like 7 minutes, the ones that I'm looking at, Sexy and The Men All Pause.
Oh, which, yes.
Yeah, so can I play The Men All Pause? Or
you can play any song you'd like. And
okay.
Everyone should know that even a turntable in my show, Yoshi's, on the 13th of this month, I am performing these songs. So.
Right. Yeah, and it's Yoshi's in Oakland, which is 510 Embarcadero. And we have 3 pairs of tickets. So if you like me on Facebook or comment on the blog here at Wanda Speaks, then you can have a pair because that's a lot of tickets.
Can they like me on Facebook?
Bernadette Cooper,
the number 2. Cooper, the number 2 on Facebook. Mm-hmm. I would love to communicate with you, and maybe at the show we can chat a little bit.
That sounds great. So here we are with this hit, The Men All Pause.
Thank you. Thank you.
Blue leather suit. My nails were done and my hair was fierce. See, I was riding in a Cooper's limousine.
Don't you want to ride? I was at home till I was crazy. So I went down to the speakeasy. The heat. The door. I had all the attention from the dance floor. Don't you know the men are paused?
The men all paused from the sides of the room. The men all.
cause I know I'm looking good. I'm giving attitude all over the room. People are staring at me. I just look too good for these people. Don't you know the mess? Yeah, just look at them. Dog is the natural dog. Radar. Radar.
Lovely, lovely. Wow. Yeah, well, you have, you know, such a wonderful, I guess, body of work. I guess when you reflect back on how much you wrote and how many hits you had, and I don't know, what do you think? And it's like, oh, my God, what do you think when you just sort of look at your body of work, you know? What comes to mind when you listen to those songs and say, oh my, what do you think about the you then and the you now?
The you then, oh gosh, I don't really reflect back very often, but lately I have been, because normally I'm moving forward and you know it's kind of like you know, I knock it down, I do it, I get it done, and then I go, okay, it's done, give it to the engineer, and I'm usually on to the next project. And I don't normally look back and look at my body of work, or my music catalog until recently. So what I think about it, I love it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm grateful for the fact that I've been able to live my dream and my passion, and I just think I've had a beautiful life. However, I do believe that the mission still continues, mm-hmm. and that's what Diva on the Turntable is about. It's just going to another level of, giving people the same music, giving people great entertainment, and just going forward and speaking with what people may want to see now, our climax. The girls out there are still kind of doing their things, the other girls.
Mm-hmm.
We do keep in touch. All is good.
Okay.
So this is a concept that I've been preparing for a few years now. It's not sudden. I've been working on the concept and wanting to do it because I wanted to tour more out in Europe. But as I look back and I look at my legacy, I think what I feel is just very grateful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I was just looking. You had a 20th century Masters Best of Climax,
mm-hmm.
and the photograph on that album is just like really powerful.
Yeah,
these beautiful, yeah. beautiful women just
Thank
looking
you.
Like don't take anything
well,
off
well,
anyone.
We most definitely emerged because when Mr. Griffey first signed us, he must have been a man with great vision because he saw the vibe and the creativity through the Jerry curls, trust me.
Mm-hmm.
So we evolved.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a beautiful thing when someone can see that,
Right.
So we evolved into the women that we are today, and, it's all good,
Yeah, so how many women were there, with Climax, And who's still, actively still performing and all that of the women that are the original members of the group?
With the original members of the group,
mm-hmm.
because we've had a lot of, musicians come in and out in the early beginnings that mm-hmm. did not work out. But when it came to the core of the group,
mm-hmm.
You have a couple of listen, Climax is Climax. We're always going to be the six ladies mm-hmm. who were involved in the history making. The history is it's already in the books. It's done.
Mm-hmm.
So we can fabricate it. We can recreate it by going out and playing. But the reality is, no matter who's a part of whatever groups, Climax is Climax, and we're the stable of the history books. Who's going out on the road? A couple of girls are not going out anymore. Lynn doesn't go out anymore. I don't believe Robin is going out anymore. So I think it's the remaining members are kind of seeing their way through, and if an opportunity pops up and, they want the girls to perform, I think they go out and do it. But I'm not quite sure, so I don't want to
yeah.
speak on that. But, everybody is still, a part of Climax. There's no mm-hmm. additional drama. It is
right.
what it is.
Yeah, yeah. Tell us their names.
Cheryl Cooley,
mm-hmm.
Robin Grider, Joyce Irby, Lynn Mosby, Lorena. I don't know if it's Shelby Hardiman. Let's see which one is. It's Lorena Stewart. She got married a couple of times. I keep forgetting. Lorena Stewart, and I believe the young lady's name is Bernadette Cooper. That's her name. So. We are the members, the core members of the group Climax.
Okay, yeah. And and you say, some members didn't work out. So, when you think about, some musicians, their company was sort of like a training ground. It was like a finishing school. It was a university.
Yes,
and it sounds
mm-hmm.
like Climax is one of those kind of places. So I was wondering how many students came through?
Oh, wow. I can't even count, but it was, I couldn't even give you an exact number, but there were many girls who, you come in, you try out a drummer, it doesn't work. Come in and try out a guitarist, it doesn't work. You think you have the group, it doesn't work. Dick Rippey comes in, he narrows it down. So there were a lot of different girls that came in. I can't remember quite their names because it was a few. Then you get with you have to travel with people and be around them for a while to realize if you're going to mesh and become as one, you know, and sometimes it just doesn't work. So the core members, or the ladies that I just spoke with you, they just, let me see, I'm trying to figure out, it was quite a few. We just, you know, I don't even remember their names.
Oh, that's okay. yeah, it just, when you said that, I was like, oh.
That's a hard question. No,
yeah.
I'm just playing with you.
Well, I mean, that's great, you know, that, you know, because, you know, there are different institutions, and Climax seems to be one of those institutions that, you know, sort of was like a training ground because, you know, because the concept of having an all-female band is not something that's replicated often. I mean, there are some other all-women groups, but there are not that many. And so so for a person to even want to be a part of that is a certain, takes a certain kind of philosophical place.
Yes.
Like, you know, to want to be in a, because like, you know, like, oh, no, men, like, wow, we have a woman leader.
It was a woman.
You know, I was like, oh.
You know, I must say that my marketing, branding mind was working like when I was 18 or 19 years old, because what I think one of the motivating factors is I saw that there was a need for it. I saw a big opening. I said, there are no female bands. Wow. Wouldn't it be cool if I did that? Wouldn't it be cool if we were able to do that? So, you know, I remember that being something that I really focused on, is taking advantage of that wide opening of there are no female bands that have been successful. And the way the Climax did it, we did it with a lot of attitude and a lot of sexiness. We really came in there and kind of shook everybody up. With I Know I'm Looking Good and Slap Me, you know, all of that vibe. And I must commend and give Jimmy and Sherry a little bit of that honor, because they came in, they produced a few of our albums, a couple of our albums, I believe, and they really gave me the go-ahead to be who I am. They inspired me to just be as crazy and wild and have fun. And so they have a lot to do with my personality.
Right. So how many albums did you have? Did you have like 10 albums or something, or how many?
I believe it was six.
Six. Okay.
I believe it was five or six. You know, because we're talking about two or three albums that we made. It didn't even chart. You know, so we were fearful at, you know, at that time. The Griffey was, you know, my mentor, Mr. Griffey, was like, you know, I'm going to stick with you, and we're going to do another album, which is unheard of in these days and times, because if you don't, the single doesn't work, you're dropped from a record company. But he stuck in there with us through three albums, and we had kind of lost faith in ourselves, I remember. You know, we were like, oh, whatever, what are we going to do? I'm going to go back to school. And that's when the menopause hit. We were all driving down the street. We were in a car. And we used to be very, very tight. And the song came on the radio. We were in an intersection. We jumped out the car. We could not believe it.
Yeah, I was looking at
it. We were very dedicated. Very dedicated to our craft. I have to say this.
Well, that's good.
Nothing comes out of you. Hard work is very, very important. And I notice a lot of people now that I work with, especially female musicians, they don't understand that nothing else can really exist when you're going after your passion, such as music especially, you know. If you want to be married, you got to be married. If you want to you know, be a banker, the fabulous career, that's what you have to do. But if you want to do music, you have to focus 100%. You have to sacrifice many, many things in order to do music, because it's a special animal. So one thing about Climax, I just remember us sacrificing, putting our money together for rehearsals, you know, going into restaurants, eating and running out because we didn't have money for food. but we did it together as a band, because we were struggling musicians with the same focus, trying to achieve this goal, and we did it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I was looking at some of your albums, looking at some of the photographs, The Best of Climax, which we were speaking of about the 20th anniversary compilation. You got Climax, mm-hmm. Meeting in the Ladies Room, Climax Greatest Hits, Max is Back, One Day, Private Party, Climax Live at Pacific something.
Yeah, some of those are subsidiaries of Climax. I wasn't involved in some of those. Like the actual albums that the entire band was involved in, I believe it was Sex, and then the group, you know, kind of started to disband, and so people were continuing out on their own. So.
Oh, with the name, though?
Yeah, some of the names don't sound familiar to me, but...
Oh, okay. Yeah, because they have your name on them. Okay, I get it.
Oh, they do? Okay.
Yeah, So maybe...
Oh, okay. Send that to my attorney.
Yeah.
They have my name on it. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, not Bernadette, but Climax, though. And
oh, yes,
started,
yes.
Yeah, uh-huh, yeah, mm-hmm. Right. interesting. And then I was also looking at the titles of these songs. They're so provocative. They make you wonder, what's this song about? Mm-hmm. You know, just the ones we played, you know, the men all pause and meeting in the ladies' room.
I have great stories, you know.
Yeah,
everything
you do.
Comes with a story. Everything mm-hmm. comes with a story.
Yeah, that's really wonderful. So I'm going to let you go in a minute, but I wonder if you could tell us another story about one of the songs I was thinking about playing just because it's so provocative. And we're just coming out of, you know, Women's History Month, which is, like, perfect. It's like every month is Women's History Month. Every day mm-hmm. is Women's
every,
History
every,
Day.
Every hour.
Right, yeah, because, like, where would anyone be
babies.
Without a woman, right?
We're raising babies, we're career women, every minute of the day is Women's Day, you know, we're doing a lot.
Right, yeah. So, Sexy,
That's sexy.
Where
all
did
right.
that come from? Yeah, what's that story?
Can I have a, oh, this is great. You have to understand that Sexy, my vision and my idea of Sexy really came from my mom, my mother, because my mother was sexy. I was a little girl, and my mother was, you know, grew up in the 60s, 70s, and was watching my mother get dressed. Back then, women really took a lot of time in putting their wigs on, right? Their wigs on, and their mini skirts and their hair, and their lashes, and my mother, I used to watch my mom get dressed, and I used to go, wow. Then her friends would come by, and they would all be in the heels, and I'd be like, wow, this is what sexy is. So I grew up with that image in my mind, and that's what I emulated, that kind of sexy, that kind of a sexy woman is what I've always wanted to be. So the title and the idea of it is just pretty much how I feel about myself, you know, and how I feel about myself, and as I was recording that song, I was in the studio, and me and my engineer, and George Clinton was in the next room. And he kept popping in, and he kept saying, I love that song. I love that song. So the next day, I went in. I was in the studio all night, you know, creating Sexy, and George Clinton popped in again. I love this song. I really want to be a part of this, writing this song. I said, of course, Mr. Clinton, you know, you can do whatever you want to do. So he says, I want to be, I said, all right. I said, why don't you take the second verse? Why don't you, you know, take the second verse? And, you know, I would love, you know, every day he came in, like 4 or 5 days continuously. Mm-hmm. So he finally came in, and I set up a microphone for Mr. Clinton, and he got on the mic, and he wrote, you know, when I comb my hair, I make it good to the comb. You know, he was like, and I was like, yes. He knew exactly what it was about. So he wrote a few lines in the second verse, and probably about right when the song was finished, I got a call from his people demanding all the publishing. Mm-hmm. For
what?
The song.
What?
Yeah, it was. Well, it was interesting. It was interesting. But I have to say this. I mean, that's one of the little quirks of the music business. However, he and I became very good friends.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever he came into town, he would call me, and I would go hang out with him in his hotel. I would just hang out with him at his hotel, and I would be around his energy because I was soaking in all that creativity, and he was always a gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
So I must add that. So that's one of the interesting things. Another thing is Lorena. Lorena, the lead vocalist of Climax, she was pregnant during that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember calling her at 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, Lorena, I need you to come. Sexy, baby, sexy. You know, she said, okay, I'm coming. I'm getting out of bed. She got out of bed, came to the studio, and dropped it in like 10 minutes and went back home. So there's a lot of interesting things that go into the makings of these wonderful songs. One day I'll write a book about it.
Yeah, I was just thinking, you definitely should.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, Mr. Clinton was just here. Dr. Clinton was just here last
week.
Yeah.
Yes, I love him.
Wow.
I love him. I mean, it was a little bit of a quirk, the attorney calls, but, you know, kind of stuff like that happens all the time. We worked it out, but
okay.
it was still a lot of things going on with that.
Mm-hmm.
Meeting in a ladies' room, might I add, now that I'm awake.
Okay.
Okay. Meeting in a ladies' room was one of those songs that it was derived. Reggie Calloway, who wrote that, wrote the music on that. He, you know, whenever we see each other out, you know, I could be I used to be a little flirtatious, you know, but Reggie was my brother. So when I see him out, I go up to him to hug him, give him a big hug. And he was with his girlfriend, and she didn't like that. And she was asking him, who is this woman? And he was like, that's Bernadette Cooper. She's my label mate. And she was like, no, she don't get off of you. I mean, we're going to have a meeting in the ladies' room. Ah, there's a song.
Oh.
Yeah.
I would never have thought that.
Yeah, that's how the song was derived.
Yeah, what kind of meeting do you have in the ladies' room? Oh, that's like step outside, huh?
But
only
women
don't step outside.
It was going into the bathroom. That's why
they step into the ladies' room.
In the scenario, this woman has her hand all over my man. You know, that I bought. That all came from that night, that evening, because I had my hands all over him. So maybe I deserved it.
Well, that's interesting. Well, you got that song out of it. That's great.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow, that is amazing how you take these scenes from your life and you recast them in song. Wow,
that is
awesome. That's like a movie,
Diva in a Turntable.
Uh-huh.
The concept that I am delivering to Yoshi's,
yes.
Oakland,
mm-hmm.
The 13th of this month.
Right.
There are two shows.
Yeah, next
for
week.
For the price of a pizza and a couple sodas, you can see Bernadette Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to come out. The drama is there. So I'm creating the drama. So if you want to see the drama of it all, you know, a version of the drama, you have to come see. The show. It's a great show.
Right. Yeah. And then you think about, you know, women and turntables, period. I mean, there aren't that many divas turning, you know, associated with turntables. You know, you sort of think about, you know, the hip hop movement.
Absolutely.
And, you know, yeah.
And I love hip hop.
Yeah.
And,
you want to hear hip hop's like predecessors. I mean, because you were doing the turntable before there was a term called hip hop.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I think my inspiration, I remember when I was beginning this project, my inspiration was really Dougie Fresh.
Mm-hmm.
Because I used to observe when we go on the road with Dougie Fresh, how we had all these instruments, but Dougie Fresh would get up there with a turntable, and he would be the headliner. He would turn the place out. So I think people, it's the character.
Mm-hmm.
And the creativity and the delivering and of the song that people really connected with. So I wanted to copy that. I wanted to be that kind of an artist who was capable of doing that. And it's been a bit of a struggle for me because I keep wanting to revert back to the band and bring in drummer and keyboard player. But the love and the beauty that we've been getting from this project is that we're able to turn the show out with just a diva on a turntable.
Mm-hmm.
And a drummer. Sometimes I bring a drummer, so.
Mm-hmm, right, and you're bringing a drummer this time, yeah.
Yes, yes.
Awesome, super. Well, I'm really looking forward to seeing you next weekend.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's going to be really awesome. And definitely want to let folks know again that we've got some tickets to give away, so make sure you hit Bernadette and make sure you hit me and let me know what you want, and so I can give you a pair of these three pairs so you can, you know, come out.
Okay,
and
it's Facebook, Bernadette2. Bernadette, the number two, or you can go into Facebook, Climax Presents Diva. No, Climax Presents Bernadette Cooper, Diva in a Turntable. You can get on that page a little easier. Yoshi's, all right, people? Yoshi's. Don't let your neighbor tell you that the show was good. Come see it for yourself. Yoshi's, the 13th, all right?
Right.
Yoshi's Oakland. Yoshi's Oakland, baby. Be there.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you, and thank you for waking me up, and now I'm ready to start my day. Thank you very much.
Oh, awesome. Well, thank you, and safe travels, you know, coming up north, and looking forward to seeing you in a week.
Okay, fabulous.
And we're gonna close this out with Sexy.
Thank you.
Right,
it's my anthem.
You. All right. Peace and bless.
Bye-bye.
for a pig. You know you need to be slapped. Gone and sing them.
That was Miss Bernadette Cooper, and she is certainly sexy, and she's bringing her group and Diva with a Turntable to Yoshi's in Oakland on Saturday evening, the 13th. She's got two shows, and I've got tickets for the second one, 10 p.m., so if you want some tickets, make sure you like me on Facebook or you blog on my radio show, and we'd love to give you a pair. Just leave me your contact information, like your email and your phone number, and we will set all that up. So far, still have three pair. It's really hard giving away tickets. I ask for tickets, and then I can't give them away. I have to give them back. So hopefully that won't be the case with Miss Bernadette Cooper. Also want to let folks know that tomorrow, besides, you know, the continuing of the Oakland International Film Festival, which kicked off on April 4th, continuing through Sunday, this April 7th, in Bay Area venues, Oakland, as well as San Leandro, Berkeley. There is also in San Francisco the Human Rights Watch Film Festival, which continues through Saturday. It started on the 4th as well. And it continues through Saturday, so it's today and tomorrow. And that's a free festival showing some really wonderful films from throughout the world and looking at human rights heroes and also some of the some areas of the world community, including here in this hemisphere, that we need to be aware of, some of the issues we might need to address. So that's a great festival that's happening as well. And Lorraine Hansberry Theater, on its Bringing the Art to the Audience stage reading series, is going to have a play by Marcus Gardley called Black Odyssey. Marcus Gardley, wonderful playwright. And this play is being directed by Stephen Anthony Jones, and it's tomorrow, Saturday, April 6th, 2 p.m. at the African American Art and Culture Complex. This is a free event, and you can always donate money. When people say free, that doesn't mean, oh, I don't want your money. No, no, you can always, always give money to the institutions that are bringing us the wonderful work that they do. You know, it can go towards future programming, as well as support in building the kind of resources that are needed to be able to produce these type of wonderful things, like these stage readings that have been going on for quite a while now, as the Lorraine Hansberry Theater sort of shifts into its new persona as it brings us traditional, you know, the stage theater, as well as work that we might want to see the theater stage. So this particular work, Black Odyssey by Marcus Gardley, is an adaptation of Homer's Odyssey, the Greek playwright Homer, Homer's Odyssey, and is set in the contemporary times. Odysseus is now a black soldier returning home from a harrowing tour in the Gulf War. With Black Odyssey, Garley seamlessly melds modern reality with ancient myth in a gripping new play. And this particular play, again directed by Stephen Anthony Jones, features Carl Lumley, Aldo Billingsley, Margot Hall, Stephen Anthony Jones, the director is also in the play, Brittany Frazier, Daryl V. Jones, Halili Knox, Kehinde Koyejo, and Dimitri Woods. It's going to really be fun. So that's 2 p.m. at 762 Fulton Street in San Francisco, African American Art and Culture Complex. And while there, you definitely need to check out the Black Woman is God exhibit, as well as the exhibit that's upstairs in the Hall of Humanity, looking at African American elders. Wonderful exhibit. I think everyone in the exhibit is 80 plus or something like that. And so that's a wonderful exhibit as well. So let's see, anything else happening that I need to let you know about? Can't think of anything right now. Oh, yes. Rodessa Jones, The Resurrection of She, continues at Brava Theater in San Francisco on 24th in York through Sunday. I'm not certain. I know it's tonight, tomorrow for sure. I saw it last week, and it is absolutely stunning, and it's really amazing how Rodessa Jones can just put these wonderful works in the world for us, and it's just quite a journey. That's in the second part. She turns her strategy of helping us repair our souls. She gives us some tools to do that in the second part of the program, where she talks about her theater company, the Medea Company, Theater for Incarcerated Women. And unlike other performances that I've seen of Rodessa Jones's canon, this particular piece also celebrates the men in her life. So we get to meet her father and her uncle and, you know, other men who have played a real positive role in her life, as well as the men that were villains. So it's really great. And she sings, and Idris Akamore and another wonderful musician, I think his name is Dave Molina, but I'm just doing this off the top of my head, so please excuse me if I'm not correct. They provide a soundscape, and it's simply fabulous. The Resurrection of She is really stunning, and it's going to become a classic, I'm sure. And also, and there are a couple of other plays that just opened or just closing as well. And out in Palo Alto, yes, Palo Alto, so far away, at the Lucy Cern Theater as a part of Theater Works Silicon Valley, they are closing. This is the closing weekend of Katori Hall's The Mountaintop, which looks at Martin King's final hours, you know, after he gave the speech in his motel room before he goes out on that balcony. And we know what happens, you know, someone's bullet sort of robs us of the rest of his presence, physical presence here on the planet. As we know it, Katori Hall does a really wonderful job in, you know, sort of imagining what could have taken place in that motel room with a real provocative hotel maid, Kame, who brings Martin King his coffee and shares a cigarette with him, and they just talk all night, and it's just a wonderful story that she brings to us in this great work that's again in in Palo Alto as a part of Theater Works. And and then just open at the Marin Theater Company is The Whipping Boy, and that's a really interesting piece, and it looks at the director's last name is Lopez, and he's out of Florida, I believe he's Puerto Rican, and he's looking at sort of the Jewish legacy, you know, former enslaved Africans who are Jewish. And this play takes place during a period known as Passover, and so it's at the end of the war. I think the Confederates have just lost that last pivotal battle, and there are two men, a young man and an older man, and then the returning son, the son of the slave master. He's wounded, and he was a captain in the Confederacy. And it's a great story about it's a great story about secrets, about the incongruency of human nature, and how, you know, one projects honor in a system that has no honor. I mean, there is nothing honorable about enslavement. There's nothing honorable about it at all. And so if one says that one is a man of God and enslaves another man or woman or child, then just within that there's an inconsistency, and that's not congruent at all. And so then how can you believe that this person can do anything honorable when they did the most dishonorable thing in owning a human being and robbing a human being of their innate or innate birthright, and that is to be free. So it's really interesting. It's really interesting. It takes us for a lot of twists and turns, and very well written, and I'm sure it's very well acted, because a couple of my favorite actors are in there, and I'm looking forward to meeting the third actor whose work I'm not certain if I know. So anyway, that just opened up this week, and it's continuing through. I'm talking about The Whipping Man. It's continuing through the 21st. You got a few minutes to go see that. And then I believe the play about Malcolm X's assassination is opening next week as well. And Amerik is the writer of that, and Michael Lange is the director. And so that's really cool. And then Cuba Caribe is coming up next week, I think. Yeah, and it's going to be happening for, I believe, 3 weeks. And there's a group coming out of Cuba, first time in the United States. And so that's going to be really, really, really hot stuff. And they're going to be at Delaney College Theater. And then they're going to be a dance mission, Cuba Caribe. It takes place over 3 weeks, and it's going to just be simply phenomenal. And I'm sure they're going to be having master classes. I know they're going to be having some lectures. John Santos, you know, scholar, musician, he's going to be giving a talk. So it's like, oh, this is so much to do. Oh, my goodness. So anyway, you don't want to miss out. The San Francisco Bay Area is just such a rich, rich, rich place. I want to thank our guest today, Jesse Douglas Allen Taylor, talking about his wonderful book, Sugary Rising. The wonderful David Roach, founder of the Oakland International Film Festival, and our wonderful guest, Bernadette Cooper. So tune in on Wednesday for another edition of Wanda's Pick, 6 o'clock in the morning. And on the 12th, we're going to be visiting the women incarcerated at Chowchilla at the California Women's Facility. So we will have a pre-recorded broadcast, and might be a broadcast of this show, might be a broadcast of Wednesday's show. You just have to tune in and check it out. We're going to be broadcasting a little bit earlier next Friday because I'm going to have to be on the road heading for Chowchilla, which is a couple of hours away, and visit our sisters and let them know that we have not forgotten them. And if you're interested in working as a volunteer, advocating for the women, writing letters, just interested in what's going on with our women inside, you can visit womenprisoners.org. And I want to give a shout out to Conda Mason for putting together a wonderful, wonderful tribute to Martin King's memory in the fundraiser benefit. Again, it's just commemoration of his life in the present tense, Martin King, in The Dream Never Dies, the East Bay Meditation Center benefit, The Dream Never Dies, a conversation on Dr. Martin King Jr.'s beloved community and where we go from here with Alice Walker, Jack Kornfield, and Michael Bernard Beckwith, moderated by Conda Mason. That was just, it was simply phenomenal. So, yeah, and the East Bay Meditation Center has a new spot, and it's just supposed to be really phenomenal, and I'm going to have to definitely get over there. So they're having an open house and a housewarming on April 27th, which is a Saturday, 1 to 4 p.m., and they're gonna, it's gonna be food, there'll be tours, you can meet the board and the staff, and you can also maybe sign up to be a monthly donor. They're looking for some folks to like dig in and support the organization in a sustainable way, so they can count on the monthly donation. So their new location is 285 17th Street at Harrison in Oakland. Again, that's 285 17th Street at Harrison in Oakland, or you can visit them online at eastbaymeditation.org. So that's going to be really fun. Again, mark that in your calendar, Saturday, April 27th, 1 to 4 p.m. All righty. So I think we're going to take it out with another one of Bernadette Cooper's, and this time we're not going to talk in the middle. We're gonna do I Look Good, okay? So, oh, yeah, because we didn't get a chance to play all of that.
Don't you see? I got it all. I look good.